Today's episode of the City of Smack Podcast on the City of Smack Podcast Network is brought to you by the City of Smack Patreon account. If you have enjoyed any of our content from the past 16 months, I believe, is how long the site's been around, which is crazy. Time flies when you're having fun. Then consider donating to the City of Smack Patreon. It's your way of showing that you really appreciate our content and that it fuels us to keep going. I believe we've been creating mostly high-quality articles, podcasts, videos, photos centered around the world of professional running, not professional running. We're bridging the gap. Whether you're a washed-up college athlete, maybe you ran track in high school, perhaps you're 35 years old and still grinding it out every day, whoever you are, CS Mag is making stuff that you'll find relatable. It's by the common runner, for the common runner. It's insightful, maybe a little bit funny. And this is our second year on the World Wide Web. We always have plans for big and new and exciting stuff. Thanks to the City of Smack Patreon backers that have already donated, we are able to get a house at the U.S. Championships, and we're able to fly out most of our writers to the U.S. Championships. So we're going to go all out for that coverage, and we really appreciate any support that Sitwits have shown us in the past 16 months, and we're looking to do more. So whether it's a dollar, whether it's $8 a month, which makes you an official member of the City of Smack Track Club, and you can buy the singlets and all this stuff that is, these singlets are actually dominating right now. We are winning races and putting the black and white of the City of Smack Track Club across the finish line first, which is very exciting to see. Not myself, but other people are doing it. It's a lot of fun, and we're having fun. We want to keep having fun, so consider donating to the City of Smack Patreon account. I'll link to it in the show notes. Anything will do. A dollar, $8 a month, $10 a month. You know, if you are a very prominent Sitwit who makes a lot of money, we'll take even bigger donations as well. It's patreon.com/CityofSmag. It'll be in the show notes as well. But for now, enjoy. This is a bonus episode of the City of Smack podcast. We're going to get back on our regular grind with more guests. The next guest will be David Ribich, the Division II star. But for now, this is a preview of the NCAA championships, which would start this week out in Eugene, Oregon. And I decided to bring on the expert, Jesse Squire, track superfan on Twitter. Follow him. Toss him a follow. Check out his column. He had the Thursday track extravaganza on cityofsmack.com. You might have been familiar with his work in one way, shape, or form. Jesse's got the voice made for podcasting. I'm very jealous. So this is a really good show. He's very smart, insightful. Let's start the show. All right, so this is a special edition of the City of Smack podcast where I bring on City of Smack contributor Jesse Squire to break down this year's NCAA championships, which take place this weekend at Hayward Field. It's the last real big meet, I guess, at Hayward Field. So, Jesse, first off, what's your favorite memory of Hayward Field?
I guess I've got two, so I'll cheat. I'll pick two. The very first time I walked up the East Grandstand, the old wooden one that's coming down, that is, to me, it's like tearing down the Green Monster, or pulling up the parquet floor, you know, to do that is, that's kind of a big deal. But the first time I walked up it, I'm walking up the ramp, and, you know, it's the Olympic trials, and the stands are full, and I said, what's that sound? What does that sound like? And it sounded like when I was a kid and was waiting in line for a wooden roller coaster at Cedar Point, just the way that lumber just rumbles. That's a special, special thing. You don't get that kind of thing very often anymore. The other one was somebody that I actually knew fairly well, ended up eighth in the trials in 2012. And she's somebody that went to the college that I ran for. And as of a few years ago, the situation was so bad there that I literally never thought I'd see anybody in a Bowling Green uniform at the Olympic trials ever again. And then she comes up and gets eighth. So that was pretty emotional for me.
So what do you make of the whole renovations? For me, it's interesting because not too long ago, I grew up a Yankee fan,
And we went through the same sort of emotions. There was so much history behind the old Yankee Stadium. And then they come up with this plan to make an entirely new one. And the new one, it's, you know, it seems so, there's just so much to do other than watch a baseball game that for the purists who love the sport, it's a totally different vibe, but it still could be a lot of fun. And I feel like it's going to be a lot of the same with the new Hayward Field, I guess, where it's going to be a track meet. If you really love the sport, you pay attention to it, but there's going to be just so much else that is going to distract people, I guess. And that's going to be part of the effort to maybe, I guess, make the sport a little sexier, but, it's still, there's nothing's going to compare to the original.
I would say the exact same thing. I grew up an hour south of Detroit, and we watched the Tigers on TV and listened to them on the radio all the time. And occasionally we'd go up to a game in the old Tiger Stadium, which was in a lot of ways not a real nice place after a while. And there was people that wanted to save it. And they end up replacing it with Comerica Park and tearing the old one down. And the old one had a lot of really, really interesting quirks. It was a really, really cool place. But again, it was old and outdated and not terribly nice. But the new Comerica Park, I think I've been there twice. It's nice. There's nothing special about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the same kind of place where Kirk Gibson would rifle a shot into the auxiliary press box in right field and tell Sparky Anderson that Sparky owed him $10, you know. I mean, it's not that same kind of magical place.
So where would you say we're going to, I guess, still get that old school track feel and like that magic? Is it Franklin Field now that kind of just inherits the title as like the old school home of track and field?
Yeah. The other thing that's special about Hayward is that, you know, especially so I ran high school track in the 80s, and back then, and even into the early 90s, a lot of kids growing up just had no idea who Steve Prefontaine was. That's kind of impossible to get past now. But back then, Eugene was sort of like this enchanted forest where time didn't pass. And they had this old school, and everybody was, but it's definitely not the way it was in the 80s. Distance running was passe, and besides the fact that Americans were terrible at it. But it was sort of like this place where it was like track and field Neverland. and so the closest thing that you could probably say to that now would be Des Moines.
That's incredible, because it's like you think Drake Relays and then a couple U.S. championships. But other than that, there's nothing really that's drawing people to go. Like, no one's saying, I want to go run at Drake University for the track team, which is not the case with Oregon and Hayward Field. It's just, you want to run for Oregon, and it just so happens that they compete at Hayward Field. It's not you don't get that, I guess, with Drake.
Yeah, and the same is true probably at Penn.
Right.
Although both Drake and Penn, their track programs weren't very good. To be kind of nice, it's kind of nice to say they weren't very good as of a few years ago. But Penn has really turned things around really quickly, and Drake is about in the first year of that. And you watch in about 4 or 5 years, it would be hard for Drake to win the Missouri Valley Conference, because that's a really tough conference, and Drake just doesn't have some of the advantages that some of the other universities have. It'd be kind of like, you know, Vanderbilt trying to be competitive in the SEC. Maybe not like that, but something like that. And but I think the new coaches there are really going to do something.
So let's get right into this year's NCAA championships. So the way I guess we decided to break it down was 5 athletes to watch, 5 storylines to watch, and then a couple records, I guess, that might be broken. So where do you want to start? Do we want to go athletes first?
Let's go with 5 races to watch.
Definitely. All right, I'm in.
Okay, 5 races to watch. My first one I'm picking is the men's 800. And that's because the 800 is always an interesting race to watch. It's kind of a crapshoot. It's extremely unpredictable. But the other thing is that this year it's kind of like unpredictable taken up a notch. Because we've got Michael Cerruti from UTEP, broke the collegiate record this year, But if you remember back at the NCAA indoors, he almost did not make the final.
Yeah, it's so he's been up and down all throughout the year. It's fascinating to watch because he seems to be a character.
Yeah, he's a fantastic talent and a great runner, but he's not a great tactician. And in the 800, that can actually really make a big difference. So, you know, there was a time when college kids raced a ton and you'd figure it out as you went along. That time is gone, probably several decades ago. Although until a few years ago, again, Eugene was that place that where you would be racing a ton. If not Cerruni, I'm not really exactly sure who to watch, because everybody's eyes kind of like on him. Although there's a guy who's been around, it seems like he's been around forever. I believe Robert Heppenstall is still at Wake Forest. Is that correct?
I believe so. Yeah. And I guess Isaiah Harris is also a name where I'm just like, it sounds like we've been talking about these guys forever.
Yeah. Harris is the guy to, yeah. If it's not Cerruni, it probably is Harris. But Harris himself is one of those where he's been around forever. He's run tremendously fast. And yet, it seems like he hasn't really won a big one yet.
Right.
Okay. Next one, it's not really a race, it's a field event to look at, is the women's hammer throw.
Okay, hit me with this. I know nothing about it.
Okay. So Maggie Ewan is like the superstar. She's got a chance to win three throwing events, shot, discus, hammer. She's breaking records all over the place. And earlier this year, she lost the hammer throw to the woman that broke the collegiate record while she was doing it. notes here correct so I don't goof up and say the wrong name. But she lost to... Ewan rebroke the collegiate record, I think. Brooke Anderson. Brooke Anderson beat her at the Desert Heat Classic in late April there at Arizona. So it's one of those where Ewan is a huge favorite, and yet she's lost. And she's lost to somebody who's thrown really, really far.
So that's back-to-back events here that we have, like, favorites who seem vulnerable.
Yes. Okay. The next one to go on to is the men's 5,000.
Well, real quick, let's give the listeners, I guess, when they should be tuning into some of these events. So the men's 800-meter final will be Friday afternoon, I believe, at 6:44 Pacific time. When is the women's hammer throw final?
That is Thursday afternoon. It's 1:30 Pacific time, which is 4:30 on the East Coast.
Perfect. All right. And then now you said want to move on to the men's 5,000.
Yeah, men's 5,000. And that's another one where we've got a bunch of favorites. I'm not really sure who to pick in this one.
It's wild. I'm looking at some of these names here, and it's just absolutely stacked from top to bottom. I mean, and a lot of these names are some of the people who finished, toward the top of the NCAA cross country championships, which is no surprise there. But it's in many of those cases, you have those guys end up running the 10K during outdoors. It seems like all the big names are in the 5,000.
Yeah, the biggest name, as far as I'm concerned, is Justin Knight.
Right.
He was NCAA cross country champion. And when he won that, it looked like he was going to win it however he pleased. He basically just went storming by right at the end. And he won the 5,000 indoors kind of the same way. But for the 3,000 indoors, Andy Truard from Northern Arizona, who is one of those guys right at the front of the NCAA cross country last November, ended up out kicking Justin Knight.
And then last year at the outdoor championships, Grant Fisher, I believe, was the one who outkicked Justin Knight.
Yes. So it's guys who can really push the pace if any of them decide to do that. They're guys with tremendous strength, but also have outkicked each other at some point or another in one way or another.
Yeah, and this race also features Kenyans like Kemboi, Kiprop, Chelenga, Kipkoech, and Keegan. And so it's like, I mean, it's the guys from, I believe it's Alabama, and all over the place. So it's like you never know how those guys are going to fare as well.
Right, right. So are we ready to go to the next next event that we're going to talk about?
Yeah, just one quick thing. If you are a City of Smag follower for the past year or so, then you have a vested interest in rooting for Dylan Maggard in the Men's 5000. He holds the Blue Jeans Mile world record at 4:11.80, I believe. And just a reminder to all the listeners, Blue Jean Mile season has already started. It started on Memorial Day and will run through Labor Day. So get your best pair of denim, 100% denim jeans. Get out there, run a mile, and see how fast you can go. So that's the plug there for the Blue Jean Mile. But Jesse, hit me with the last big event.
Okay. As far as I'm concerned, the last big one is, well, actually, we did three.
Okay, yeah, two more.
So this is number four. I'm looking at the women's 4x400, and that's only because I think that the team championship is probably going to be on the line.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. If you recall last year, it turned out to be one of those situations where Oregon at home had to win the 4x400 to come out with the championship. And they barely did it right on the very last end. Very last part of the meet, of the race.
Yeah, so the last year's winning time was 3:23.13 for Oregon, and then USC was second, 3:23.35. That's how close it was. It was absolutely ridiculous. And this year, I guess, we'll get to athletes to watch in a bit, but her name will come up, I'm sure. Sydney McLaughlin will likely, I guess, be part of Kentucky's 4x4 team, and I've actually... this is actually for the listeners, I guess, an exclusive here. I've got a story coming out, hopefully in the next couple of days, on Coach Eldrick Florial and on Sports Illustrated. And he talks about how Sydney McLaughlin has studied up on every single girl who's run the 4x4 and knows their splits, so she knows just how much faster she has to be than everyone else, which should be pretty exciting, especially if we get her versus someone like Kendall Ellis on the anchor leg. But it's definitely going to be a must watch race.
Right. And the women's team race looks like it's just going to come down to the wire. Last year, if you might recall, Georgia really didn't have anybody in the running events. It was all heptathlon and field events. And they basically came half a point away from winning the national championship. Or Oregon had to outscore them on the 4x400, and they had to beat USC to do it. And Georgia's kind of in the same situation, although they've got more running event contenders this year, especially a freshman named Lina Irby in the 200 and 400. But again, you've got USC, you've got Oregon, you've got Kentucky. They're all considered to be in the hunt, and those are basically the three best 4x400s. Purdue could end up being a spoiler in there too, although Purdue is not really figured as a team championship contender. But it really could be a three-way battle to the finish for both the 4x400 and the team championship, which is kind of insane to think about.
Yeah, doesn't that feel like such a weird way for a team to possibly win the title, the way you described, I guess, how Georgia almost pulled it off last year in terms of just like how we view it on TV? It's just you kind of are getting score updates and it's like, wait, how is Georgia scoring all these points? Because sometimes those events that they're scoring in don't get as much TV time as the actual track races. So it's like you're getting these updates. It's like, wait, how did that happen?
Yeah, if I wanted to go on a really, really, really angry rant, I could talk about more. Our team covers this. Well, you know, NCAA wrestling, wrestling is kind of a, it seems like it's a dying sport on the collegiate level, yet the television coverage of the NCAA wrestling championships is off the charts. It's incredible. They have split screens. They show every match. Sometimes there are four matches going on at once, and they're showing them all on television or online at the same time. And we can do that. We can do that. You know, we can have, you know, a bigger frame for the track events, and we can have, you know, one or two frames on the right or the left for a field event. You can have a ticker across the bottom that's giving you updates on field events as they're going. Because, you know, if you're really plugged into a meet, you know, using all the mobile technology that you have to you, that's what you're doing anyway. You're getting updates on the field events as they're going along. And if you're there in person, I was fortunate enough to do that, to be there last year. You are able to keep, you know, one eye on the long jump and one eye on the shot put while track races are going on.
Yeah, we need you to write the pretty much a media review of just how ESPN covers the NCAA championships, just giving grades on like, hey, here's what they did right, here's what they did wrong. You could be an excellent media critic for that, I believe, Jesse.
Oh, but there's one announcer I wouldn't be able to get past. he was once excellent, but those years are gone by.
yeah, no, and I'm hoping to get John Anderson on the podcast at some point, so I have to be nice as well.
Well, you know, to be honest, from what I understand, you know, it's a production company that makes all the calls, and so it's not necessarily ESPN. It's a production company that they hire. Are we ready to go to our last event?
Hit me.
Okay, last event. Men's 4x400. Do you notice a certain particular fascination with the 4x400?
Yeah.
Well, to me, that is the king of races, the 4x400. I'm the guy that could and has some high school 4x400s at the Penn Relays.
Hold on, Jesse. Can you repeat that? Because you cut out for a second.
Okay. I am the guy who can and has sat and watched all 2 hours of high school 4x400s at the Penn Relays.
That's incredible.
Yeah. The 4x400, to me, it kind of combines everything that you have to be a good track team. And that's why very often the best teams have teams, you know, contending to win the 4x400. And with that in mind, the top teams in the men's 4x400 are USC, Texas A&M, Florida, Houston. Those are basically the top teams. And while it looks like Florida is about a lock to win the men's championship, you never really know how things are going to play out. And USC and Houston are, if Florida doesn't win it, USC and Houston are two teams that just might have a shot at it.
Right. And especially given how we saw the indoor race play out.
Right. And then the other thing is that USC is just so good. It's unbelievable how fast they are. And at NCAA regionals, which is, okay, excuse me, preliminary round, over in the West, Michael Norman ran down Texas A&M from behind to win their heat, which is a qualifying heat. You know, to me, it's, why do you care? But at the same time, you know, if you're a competitor, you're a competitor, right? And Norman ran 43.06 or something like that.
Yeah, which is the second fastest relay split of all time.
Yeah, and then Southern Cal also has Ry Benjamin, who's the first collegian to run 47 in the hurdles in 400 hurdles in a while. You know, when you get down into 47 point something in the 400 hurdles, you're moving out. That'll win most Diamond League meets. So. You know, they've got those two guys, and but then on the other hand, you know, Houston won the Penn Relays, and their anchor leg ran the fastest anchor in the history of the Penn Relays too. So, you know, it could, even without any team championship titles out there to be won or lost, this race could just be fantastic anyway.
Definitely. So what does if you look at kind of your projections, or just looking at how you've kind of maybe you've scored some of the meet, what would a drop baton do for Florida here? Is it over? They just lose, right?
Possible. The track and field news form charts have Florida, they're form charting them to win, to score 63, and Houston to score 41.
Okay.
So, you know, it's possible. I will say the worst telecast of a track meet I've ever seen was however many years ago, I think it was 2013, but I can't recall exactly, when Texas A&M pretty much had the championship put away. All they had to do was not finish last in the 4x400, and they dropped a baton. And even then, the only way they could not be champions is if they finished last and Florida won the 4x400. And that's exactly what happened. The announcers did not realize that's what was happening, or that what was going to happen. And possibly my favorite championship trophy picture ever was both Pat Henry and Mouse Holloway holding up the team championship trophy. And Holloway's look on his face said, "I can't believe I'm sharing this trophy." And Henry's look said, "I can't believe I'm sharing this trophy." You know? So there's history for this to have happened before.
Definitely. All right. So let's move into athletes to watch.
Yes. Five athletes to watch.
All right. Well, who do you got as your first one?
Sydney McLaughlin. Have you heard of her?
Never.
Yes. Okay. So what's on her plate is the 400 hurdles, the 4x100 and the 4x400. And so we know, you know, the relays are always just fun by themselves, and there could be team championships on the line. But for the 400 hurdles, you know, the possibility that she breaks the collegiate record, it seems like, well, that's just going to happen. The question is, could she actually have a shot at the world record?
It's crazy. 18 years old, and that's the conversation we're having.
Right. And I did some research, and the last time a world record, like an outdoor official, you know, regulation event world record was set at the outdoor championships was 1976. It was Dwight Stones winning the high jump. The NCAAs were at Franklin Field that year. And the last time it was done in a running event was like 1971 or something like that. And it's not once, never happened in the women's events.
Has it happened at Hayward?
I'm sorry, which?
Has it happened at Hayward Field?
As far as a record being set, a world record being set, I don't think it has.
Okay.
Because the last, it was done in 1976, 1971, and 1970. I think 71 was in Knoxville, and I know 70 was at Drake. And before that, I think Hayward only hosted the NCAAs twice, I think 62 and 64.
Okay, so that would be an ultimate way of putting the cherry on top at Hayward Field.
Absolutely, absolutely. Next athlete to watch is Michael Norman.
Mm-hmm. No surprise.
Yeah. So Norman was high school sprint star, 100 and 200, and didn't have a great year last year. Either they were holding him back, or he was a little injured, or maybe a little bit of both. And then, so now we really understand the 400 is his event. Yeah. Holy cow, it's his event. And all of that sounds to me exactly like Quincy Watts. I don't know if that's a name that means anything to you.
It is, Jesse. I know I'm super young, but I've done my research.
Yeah. Well, so, and Watts was, again, same thing. He was a record-setting 100, 200 guy in high school. Had a lot of hamstring problems when he went off to college at USC as well, by the way. He's originally from Southern California. They moved him up the 400. And the summer after his senior year at USC, He's Olympic champion, runs 43.50, which is still number 9 on the all-time world list. And so it looks like the same story over again, except that Norman seems faster already, you know? And so I think I would have to look things up here. I don't really get that much into records. I think the collegiate record is 44 flat. And you get the feeling that, that was Watts at the 92 NCAAs at Texas. But you get the feeling that Norman, he could do it. He could break that.
Well, wasn't it Fred Curley who broke the record?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did it last year. Okay, my memory is failing me. As I'm saying, I don't get into records that much. Yeah, he did that at the NCAA prelims last year. Mm-hmm. I guess the meet record is 44 flat.
Gotcha. Back and fall.
Yeah. So 43.70. But even that, you get the feeling that that Norman has a shot at that. He could do it.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what I really love is the fact that him and Noah Lyles are coming around at the same exact time. We got a taste of them at the 2016 trials. And then all of a sudden, last year, I guess both had a little bit of injury woes. And now this is their big breakthrough year. It's a shame it's in a non-championship year because you would love to see what these kids do on the world stage. But at the same time, that's not a bad thing because after a long season like this, I'm guessing Norman could take off some time after possibly the U.S. Championships, is my guess.
Yeah. One of the things that I think maybe is why he's running so incredibly fast now is, you know, the coaching staff probably doesn't think that there's a whole lot of reason to save stuff for later in the year.
Exactly.
So, okay, ready to go on to my next athlete to watch?
Yep.
Is Carissa Schweitzer.
Yep. History could be in the cards for her, right?
Yeah. I don't know how fast she intends to run so much as she's going to try out to go out and win the 5,000, 10,000 double. So she's doing the 5,000, 10,000 is first. Thursday night, I think it's like 9:38 or something like that on Thursday night, 9:38 Eastern time, 6:38 on the West Coast. And then she'll come around on Saturday and try to do it again in the 5,000. And as far as getting beat in anything longer than a 1500, I don't know when it last was. It could be cross country, not this last fall, but the year before.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. And she hasn't run a lot of 10,000s in her career, I don't think. So that's that would be kind of new for her. But on the other hand, you know, she's just been so dominant that you figure it's hard to imagine her not winning it. You
know? Yeah. So who are some of the – I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Maybe you know better. Some of the women who have swept both – the 5K and 10K in history?
Well, I'm going to do some research on the fly while we're on the computer here, while we're recording this, because I'm not really sure how many times it's been done. So I've got some sources through 2006 right here. Amy Skiras from Arizona did it back-to-back years in 97 and 98. Through 2006, that's all I know. Okay. I'm not sure. Okay, last 12 years, things are starting to blend together in my head, so I'm not really sure. But it's not a real common thing.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty crazy. Then that would be a really big double for her. I'm guessing some of the people who could challenge her is probably like Edna Kurgat, who won the NCAA championships for cross country in the back in the fall. I'm guessing Ollie Ostrander is going to double back from the steeple to run the 5,000.
Yeah, yeah. Although, dude, that's a really tough one day double.
Yeah,
that is incredibly difficult to do in one day. Although, I'm not really sure off the top of my head. I think somebody tried it last year.
Yeah, it could have happened. I mean, and then I'm just trying to rattle off some of the big names. Aaron Finn, we saw just, I guess, how much he laid it out on the line during the preliminary round that she'll be in there as well. And she's competed at the just among pros in the past. And that's something that we saw with Schweizer earlier in the year, racing against someone like Gwen Jorgensen and at the Stanford Invitational. So, I mean, it's that's definitely going to be one of the must watch events. Definitely later on in the night on the East Coast. I might have to stay up for that, especially when it's that long of a race. But I'm in for it.
Okay. Another one that I think, you know, you'd never really want to count anybody out. I would also throw out Charlotte Taylor and Wenny Colati as two people who could possibly be in there for the fight to win.
Taylor won it last year, right?
Yeah. So it looks like it's going to be a great race, and everybody's going to have a little bit on their legs, but a 10,000 for Schweizer definitely is going to make that 5,000 a little bit harder of a victory than she had during indoors when she won the five.
Cool. And let's see, is that number three or number four?
That is number three. So I got two more. Next one to watch is Grant Holloway, the superstar hurdler and long jumper for Florida.
He's quite the character, at least from what I've guessed on Twitter and from his celebrations at indoors. He's a superstar in the making, at least for the U.S.
Yeah. As far as, you know, somebody who's that good in both the long jump and the hurdles, I'm not sure that there's that anybody's been like that before. And he also runs both relays for Florida as well. So we're looking at a 4-event day. And the other thing is, he's approaching Skeets Nehemiah area in the 110 hurdles, being that fast as a collegian.
Because he ran 13:15 earlier this year?
Yeah, at the SECs.
And the record is 13 flat?
Yes. And to think that it's been since the late 70s since somebody's run that fast in college track. But on the other hand, in 1978, there was no leaving college early to go for a pro contract. That just wasn't going to happen in 1978.
So if Holloway wins, this would be four championships in 4 years for him?
Yes.
How common is that?
You're talking four team championships or individual?
Four individual.
Actually, he's just a sophomore.
That's right. You're right.
Second year. Yeah, he won last year.
That's what I meant. Yeah, four and four.
That happens. For example, Kristen Coleman won four of them last year. And it happens, but it's rare.
It feels much rarer with the hurdles because so much can go wrong.
Yeah, there's 10 things that can go wrong. just why I love the high hurdles, because it's a disaster waiting to happen. Even in the women's hurdles, where the hurdles aren't quite as high, you know, you just don't have to look any further than Lolo Jones to know that nothing's secure until you're across the finish line.
Exactly. So if Holloway doesn't win, who is the second best odds? And if you put down a dollar on them, now that we're talking that gambling might be legalized all across the country, I guess like those odds would be pretty good just if you wanted to put down a dollar.
Sure. Reuben Walters is from Alabama, is probably the second best hurdler. Next best is a guy from Illinois named David Kenziera. And those are probably the next best guys. But honestly, Holloway is so much better that he'd really have to fall. I mean, it's not just hitting a hurdle and slowing him down that would be an issue so much as he'd actually have to take a fall, I think, for him to not win the 110 hurdles. As far as the long jump, that's kind of like, he was leading until the very last jump at the NCAA indoor. So he's capable of pulling off a hurdle long jump double.
That's pretty cool. And during the indoor championships, he pulled off some sort of a Fortnite celebration. So Jesse, you are a teacher. How much are your students talking about Fortnite? And what is your understanding of Fortnite?
I try to pay attention to the students as little as possible. I'm just playing. But school's already out for me. I turned in my stuff last week. So they were talking about it towards the end of the year. And I remember one kid just saying, hey, Fortnite's just popular because it's free.
So, there you go. You've got plenty of time to play Fortnite this summer, Jesse.
No, I'm watching track meets all the time. Okay, ready to go to my last athlete to watch.
Yep.
Maggie Ewan. Already okay. Talked about her once. As a favorite in the hammer and a record holder, but someone who actually, it's quite possible she could get beat. But in the shot and the discus, the shot, she's a clear favorite. And the shot put is an event where a little bit less can go wrong. In the discus, she could win too. That she could win a throwing triple, which is, again, that's one of those where I'd have to say, I'm not sure if it's been done before. But it would be exceedingly rare.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think of like some of the names that you left off of your like athletes to watch. There's some good ones out there as well. So like for me, I guess just first off, I love watching the men's 1500 at the NCAA championships every year. But it just seems like this year it's Josh Kerr head over heels. Just head and shoulders above the rest of the competition. Maybe Sam Prakel could be the next guy right after him, but this guy's just. He's a clear favorite in this case.
Yeah, and it's not because of the records. Okay, 1500 is an event where running a fast time has actually the least to do with winning a championship race. It's that he's already shown on multiple occasions just how good a tactician he is. When we all thought that Chesarek was unbeatable in the indoor mile, Kerr schooled him, you know.
Yeah.
And last year, outdoors, won dominant. Indoors, he won again. It's not because of his fast time, his collegiate record that he set. It's because he doesn't lose. Mm-hmm.
Now, another name, Cameron Burrell, someone who's only lost at the NCAA championships. Like, is this the year he can finally, you know, get the monkey off his back and win at least in the 100?
He might. There's a lot of good guys in the 100, and they're not, you know, there's nobody that kind of sticks out in my head as being head and shoulders above the rest, which means that whoever executes the best, whoever is able to maintain relaxation and not decelerate the most at the end of the race, that will be the guy that wins. And if Cameron Burrell can learns from his coaches at Houston, then I figure he's going to do that better than anybody, because you want to talk about someone who executed and never tightened up late in a race. It was Carl Lewis.
Yeah. And I guess it feels so weird to not be talking about the 100 as much, because we were just spoiled for the last couple of years with Trayvon Bermell and then the seamless transition right into Christian Coleman. And now I guess it's like the NCAA champion is going to be really good, but those two in the past couple of years were Olympic and world championship caliber.
Right. And this is sort of a step back in talent. You know, we were talking about how in the 200 and the 400, we've had a big step forward in talent. So I guess everything, you can't have superstars everywhere, I guess.
Yeah. The other name and the last one, I guess this is just to throw out one female runner out there. It's Jasmine Camacho Quinn from Kentucky, but we might get to her, I guess, if she's on your list of possible records that could fall. So let's hit those.
Okay. So records that could be broken. Very first one we already talked about, women's 400 hurdles. And the question, and in my notes next to that, I wrote world question mark, then world record that could be broken. Men's 400 meters. Again, we already 70 is the collegiate record for that, and Michael Norman has those in him. Women's 4x100. LSU already broke the collegiate record this year.
So it's just a matter of can they go faster?
Yeah. Well, I think they had four finalists in the 60 at the NCAA indoor. You knew that, you know, once they were passing a baton outdoors, you knew that records were possible. Mm-hmm. Men's 800, Michael Cerruti also already has the collegiate record. And championship races and the distance races, usually you don't see records being broken, but the 800 you do. And if he lines everything up, he could do that.
It's funny how that he set the record earlier this year, and there was just kind of like no one really batted an eye because it didn't happen at a championship setting, as opposed to when Donovan Brazier broke it, and it was, you know, at Hayward Field at the NCAA Championships on the 50th anniversary of Jim Ryan's record. This one wasn't as celebrated as much. So to a lot of people, they don't even realize that he's the collegiate record holder.
Yeah. And well, the other thing is that he runs for UTEP, and it's a little bit away from, you know, where there's no media center for track and field, but El Paso is even further off the beaten path than most. Another one that I'm looking at is women's hammer throw. That one seems like the record's broken every year. Deanna Price just broke the American record. It's one of those events that it's still relatively new. For women. And so the improvement curve is still pretty steep. Mm-hmm. So that could happen. Men's 110 hurdles. We talked about that. And that if Holloway can break Ronaldo Nehemiah record, that's one of those things where you say, okay, that record has stood for about 40 years. That if you can break a 40-year-old record, that's something special. But it's Hayward Field, you know, and as it's currently set up, you know, it's part of the magic of it is that it's just a really, really fast facility. You know, besides anything, besides it being a really pretty facility and a facility where people turn out to really watch the event, but it's fast too. It's a lot of people's favorite place to race for a reason.
Definitely. And I guess like we've got a couple listeners who go to Harvard because I've met a couple of them. So we'd get some feedback if we didn't mention Gabrielle Thomas. So does she have a shot at a collegiate record? Even though, what is that for the 200? Who holds that one? Is it her? She has the indoor one.
Yeah, let me pull that up. And the meet record is 22:02 by Kyra Jefferson. That's also the collegiate record, and that was last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was when I think was it Ariana Washington or was it another Oregon runner was going shoulder to shoulder with Jefferson and down the backstretch and just tightened up, tied up, and fell. And that was another place where Oregon was expecting to get a ton of women's points, and they came away with very little. And so that really took the air out of the crowd right then, where everybody thought, okay, they're going to clinch the championship on this event, and they didn't. And then the next event it came along at the 5,000. They're going to clinch the title on this event, and they didn't. And event after event last year in Oregon, things did not go the way they were supposed to. But yeah, 22:02 by Kyra Jefferson. That's the record.
That could be in the cards. I could see that. All right. So I guess were those all the rundowns that we planned ahead of time?
I've also got five storylines.
That's right. Hit me with those.
Okay. My storyline number one is my favorite thing about college sports in general. The storyline to watch is your favorite team. That's the cool thing about Division I athletics. There's over 300 teams. There's not that many at the NCAA championships, but it's kind of like the basketball tournament. There's so many teams early on that if your team's not in it, there's somebody that you kind of sort of like. So I ran at Bowling Green a long time ago, and Bowling Green's got two women that qualified for the first time forever. And so Bowling Green in Toledo, it's almost as mortal enemies as Ohio State and Michigan. But when you get to this point of the competition, your mortal enemy kind of becomes your friend. You know, you're kind of cheering for them over everybody else around the whole country. You might think they're my enemy, but they're my enemy. They're not anybody else's. And Toledo's got a woman that qualified. I don't know if you remember the story of Janelle Noe. She missed two entire seasons with severe third degree burns that she experienced. She was trying to stop someone from doing something stupid that could have burned down an entire house at a campus party. And she ended up missing two whole seasons recovering from burns. I think she was out of school for a semester or a year. She returned to running last year, and she's not only broken her personal record, she's broken the school record, the Mid-American Conference record multiple times. She's run 4:16. And so you think, wow, this person has had an incredible comeback. She very easily could be a finalist and run on Saturday. And if you're a finalist on Saturday, you never know what's going to happen. If you're on the track, you got a chance.
Yeah, I'm hoping to some extent, hopefully the broadcast mentions that. It is an incredible story.
Right, right. And everybody's got a favorite team. So whoever your favorite team is, you know, you've got somebody you can watch.
Yeah, Marquette, I don't think has had an individual qualifier in a while. It definitely hasn't gone as a team in a bit. So, I haven't had a rooting interest yet. But then again, as a capital J journalist, I shouldn't have one. So I'll stay unbiased for this one, too.
Okay. My next storyline is the Women's Team Championship. There's five teams that have a legitimate shot at winning the whole thing. There's five teams. Any of them could pull it out. Georgia, USC, Oregon, Kentucky, and Stanford. And so as the weekend goes along, you know, some of those teams are going to fall away and some of them are going to come forward. But it still could be a 2-, 3-, or 4-way battle going into the very last event.
Wait, so we'll save your predictions for the end of the show.
Okay. All right. My next storyline to watch is in the men's competition. It's Houston versus the Power Five. Okay. Houston is the first group of five team to have a legitimate shot at being NCAA champions since the early 80s.
Interesting. Well, see, I've heard that stat thrown around, but then there was a counterpoint that I heard recently. I'll let you keep going, and then I'll see if I can pull it up. Someone actually texted me about this.
Okay. Well, SMU won in like 1984, 85, but that was when they were in the old Southwest Conference. It had Texas and Texas A&M and a lot of other major programs. So the Southwest Conference really was a power conference back then. If you go for a real mid-major, it was UTEP in 1982.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me see. You can keep going, and I'll chime in when I pull this up.
Okay. Now, it's kind of a long shot. Eli Hall, their superstar from indoor track season, must be hurt or something like that because he didn't make it in the 200. So that kind of hurts their chances. But at the very, very least, you know, they're the top 10 teams. They're probably going to be the only one from outside the Power Five in the top 10. They do have a little bit of recruiting advantage. If Carl Lewis pays you a visit, pay attention. Okay. But at the same time, they've earned it. I mean, they've got not just sprinters. They've got quarter milers. They've got a hurdler, Amir Latin, who is a scoring, could score in either hurdle race. And they've got a steeplechaser who's actually the favored to win the steeplechase. That's Brian Barazza.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a good team all the way around. I think they've got a javelin thrower that is a potential scorer as well. So, you know, they're a full team.
Yeah. Not
just a sprint school.
Yeah, so I actually just got – it was a text from a buddy of mine a couple weeks back because someone did bring up the stat, but he said by all modern standards, the Southwest Conference was a power conference in 1986, the year before SMU got the death penalty. So do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And was I the guy that sent you that text?
No, you weren't.
Oh, okay. Because I posted pretty much that.
Wait, hold on. What was that? You just cut out for a sec.
Yeah, I saw you cut out too. I said, I posted that almost word for word on Twitter.
Well, yeah, no, it wasn't you, but the same exact point was made to me.
Yeah. Okay, so my next storyline is new superstars emerging for the 2019 Worlds and the 2020 Olympics.
Okay.
And those are a lot of those athletes to watch that we talked about. Sydney McLaughlin, for sure, Michael Norman, Grant Holloway, some of these other people. But these are a lot of the people you're going to see at the NCAAs this week. These are going to be the ascendant athletes, the new athletes that are going to be trying to break into the national team, trying to break onto the podium, or maybe even win gold at the World Championships and the Olympics over the next 2 years.
So that's a great point that you make, because recently I was thinking about just Allyson Felix as an incredible athlete, and the just how decorated she's been in her entire career. She's said how she wants to go through 2020, and when you think about this in 2016, and you're riding the high of her performances, you're like, you know, I don't see any reason why she wouldn't be able to make it to 2020. But then, you know, you give it a year or two, and where we are right now, kind of like in the middle of the two Olympic cycles, I might not see Allyson Felix making the next Olympic team, at least in the 400, because this collegiate class and some of the athletes like Phyllis Francis and Courtney Okolo have just been taking it to another level, where they've definitely closed the gap on just her dominance in the event, and might have even already surpassed her. So just given this wave of youth that we've got going, I think you raise a great point where, yes, we enjoyed the superstars that were on the 2016 team, but the 2020 team is going to have a bunch of fresh faces, and a lot of them will be competing this weekend.
Yeah. I read through a whole bunch of old track stuff, old things here and there. I've got all kinds of archives. And one of the things that I see about being different about Olympic coverage, say in 1968 or 1972, was that there was no expectation that the people from the last Olympics were still going to be around, because of the nature of how things were at the time, that you couldn't make any money off for it, or at least you couldn't do it openly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Olympics were a lot bigger deal, actually, in certain ways than they are now, even. And so a lot of what drove Olympic coverage in a quadrennium was, who are going to be the next stars? Who are going to be the people that make the team? Who are going to be the people that are going to be fighting for medals and for gold medals? And so one reason why college track got so much attention was because that was where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
That's where those new stars were coming from. And so if you went to, say, the Pac-12 or the Pac-8 championships way back then, in any event, you could say, yeah, whoever wins Pac-8 this year, you wait 2 years, they're on the Olympic team, you know? And so that's it. Heck, even a dual meet between UCLA and Oregon in like 1970 or 71, you'd look at those, that meet, and you'd say, it's going to be a lot of Olympians in that meet. And
definitely.
As well, who are they going to be? So, okay. And my last storyline is something that we started with, the last show at Hayward Field, at the old Hayward Field.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think there's a lot of collegians that probably feel very, very fortunate just to be running in the stadium the last time it's going to be configured the way that it is right now.
So did you ever get a chance to run on the track there?
I can't recall, but I don't think I actually have. I don't think I have.
Okay. I did it for one of the all comers miles at the trials. I may have just barely dipped under 6 minutes, but I guess like I'll never, I guess, be able to have that sort of experience ever again.
Right. Yeah. I know I've walked down onto the track and onto the field. But as far as running on it, and yeah, the other thing is I'm old, I'm broken down, I'm overweight. To feel like I was running on that track, I would feel like there would be parts of me falling off me as I went down the track behind me, like the Florida Keys, you know.
All right. So before we go, I guess predictions, right?
Yeah.
All right. So hit me. I guess your predictions for the men's and women's team winner.
The men's championship, I don't see Florida losing. They've been there before. It's kind of a trite thing to say they know how to win. But on some level, you know, when everybody's looking at you, there is that experience of, okay, I can do this. I've done this before. They've got so much room for error that, we've said that about Oregon women in the past, but I really do think that that Florida has enough room for error and enough experience that it's going to be hard for them to lose.
So how many titles would this be for Holloway at Florida?
Oh, God, I don't know. He's won a ton of them.
Yeah.
Between indoor and outdoor, I can't even begin to count them up. But, you know, suffice to say, again, he knows what you have to do to get a team ready,
mm-hmm.
Both physically and mentally.
Definitely.
I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say USC is going to win the women's championship.
Wow, that's an interesting pick.
Yeah, I just think that USC really was not that great until they hired Carol Smith Gilbert, and things have just gotten better year after year after year. They've become a really tough team. And I just have a feeling that this is going to be the time where they get over the hump and they get over the top. You always talk about, well, Oregon has a home advantage. But sometimes that hasn't worked out in the past. I will say that one thing that does help USC a lot is that they are not coming from the Eastern time zone. They are staying in their time zone to travel, and that does make a difference.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, well, I really do believe one reason that some of the world championships and Olympics where the USA has really struggled were in Korea and China.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being 12 and 13 hours off, it does make things really, really hard. In collegian, okay, so some of them may have been in Oregon for almost a week before things started. But I know the Bowling Green athletes took off on Saturday and they don't compete till Thursday. So they had a good bit of time to get acclimatized to everything. But still, you know, if you're coming from the Eastern time zone and you go out west, it takes a little while for your body to adapt.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'll blame. Me just barely dipping under 6 minutes for that mile at Hayward Field. That's what I'm blaming it on. So Jesse, just real quick on that women's team pick, you envision that coming down to the final event, the 4x4?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think USC can win it. Last year, Raven Rogers just willed herself to win that for her team. I thought that she was if I were to pick athlete of the meet, to me, it was Raven Rogers, not for any records or anything other than she just picked her team up on her back, and she was one of everybody had a bad day except Raven Rogers. She came out and just was gangbusters beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the very same thing could end up happening in the 4x400. Kendall Ellis is probably the favorite to win the open 400 for USC. And so if she's within, the only person I think that could outrun her could be wearing a Kentucky uniform, McLaughlin. But even then, you know, if it's close, you just don't know. You just don't know. But I think USC is going to be in front of Kentucky going into the last exchange anyway. So. I definitely think the 4x400 is going to determine who wins the women's championship. And that's actually why I think USC is going to win, because I think they've got the best 4x400.
Perfect. Well, there you have it. That's Jesse Squire with all the NCAA analysis for the preview, the official preview for this weekend. Now, Jesse, I feel like we're going to get a lot of compliments on your voice, so we have to come up with a good podcast idea and get you going, because it's a voice made for podcasting. It's a voice made for radio. You do some announcing at meets. I'm gonna try and think up some ideas.
Okay, yeah, I do as much announcing as I can, and I am always available for hire.
Definitely,
put that out there. Okay, you pay my travel, and I'll be there. So,
and the other thing, Jesse, you put out a tweet a while ago about the track and field bar that you've got. What's the deal with that?
I am sitting in it right now. I'm recording from it. The house I bought 10 years ago had a basement bar in it, sort of a 1950s style thing with some old knotty pine. And I just decorated the whole thing with various track crap that I got. eBay is just the best. I can give you a video show sometime if you would really like that. If you want to do a video sometime for Sidious Mag, I can do that. And just about 3 weeks ago, we assembled the tiki bar in the backyard.
That's what I was wondering about, the tiki bar. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's something I built out of some just leftover pieces and parts sitting here and there. I have two bars in my house. I'm not a drunk, I swear. I'm considering titling that the Chris Brown Track Bar. And I'll just let people guess as to whether it's named after the famous 400 meter runner from the Bahamas, because it's all decorated in Caribbean, including the bar top is painted in a Bahamas flag. Okay. Or if it's named after my high school teammate that was a three-time Big East champion for Georgetown when he ran for Frank Gagliano back in the late 80s, early 90s.
And so it's not the pop artist that all the kids are talking about?
No.
There is a Chris Brown pop artist. Yes. I was going to say, are you only playing Chris Brown tunes at this bar? But that's not the case.
No.
All right. So it's an open invite to any Sidious Mag podcast listener who happens to be rolling through Ohio.
I'll be the guy standing out there waving.
There you go. Jesse, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. And everyone can follow Jesse throughout the weekend where he'll be watching the track meet and live tweeting it. So it's at Track Superfan. You can follow him there. And I'm sure we'll get his thoughts after the meet in some sort of column or something like that. But Jesse is the Track Superfan and the expert when it comes to the NCAA.
All right. Thanks for having me on.